welcome to another edition of At Large. I'm Lenny Holloman. And my guest this week is Katie Knight, who is the co-curator of education at the Holter Museum in Helena. And she is also the primary curator for a very interesting exhibit that the Holter has opened up. I believe it opened up on January 26th, and the exhibit will go through April 15th of this year. It's an exhibit titled Speaking Volumes, Transforming Hate. And what the exhibit is the transformation by a huge group of artists, more than 60 artists, I believe, of hate literature from the World Church of the Creator, which is a white supremacist group that may still be, certainly was active in Montana and Idaho in the 90s. These artists have taken this hate literature and transformed it into art. I have seen the catalog of the pieces that are in the exhibit, and they are astounding. And it is a very provocative exhibit, and that is what we're going to talk about. So welcome to the show, Katie.
Thank you, Lenny. Great to be here.
The first thing I want to ask is how this whole exhibit came to be. There's a whole story about how the books came to be in the hands of, I believe, the Montana Human Rights Network, and how the Holter Museum got involved, and how this idea of an art exhibit kind of evolved over time. So if you can tell us that story, that will give us a lot of good insight into how the exhibit exists in its context.
Well, as many people know, the Montana Human Rights Network monitors and works to counteract the organizing efforts of various extreme groups like the white supremacists who have tried to get a foothold in Montana and in the Northwest region. So they were aware of the activities of a group formerly known as World Church of the Creator, which has renamed itself the Creativity Movement. And they were familiar with one of the leaders who contacted them in December of 2003 saying, "Listen, I want to get out. I want to get away from these guys, and I need money to put some real distance between me and them." This person told Ken Toole and Christine Kaufman that he had in his possession the key to storage lockers in Superior, Montana, where there were over 4,000 volumes of these books written by Ben Clausen, 13 different titles, and in addition, a great deal of correspondence between various group members. This is a pretty dysfunctional group. They are just vehemently anti-Semitic and extremely racist. They are actually anti-Christian. They hate the Anabaptists like the Mennonites. And they have kept a certain continuity throughout a lot of leadership conflict and intergroup conflict because they've had these books. The books espouse their philosophy. Their books that Ben Clausen uses to really inspire the white race to supremacy and to the elimination of all people of color. And then, of course, he names the Jews as the source of the worst evils in the world, and they should be eliminated. So he's advocating genocide very clearly in these books. But because the books were in existence and providing an income stream for this group who sold them for $10 a piece, and they kept the ideas of the organization alive. So Ken and Christine leapt at the opportunity to purchase these books for a nominal fee of $300, and they drove up to Superior where they met this leader, this defecting leader, and he gave them the key, and they took the books. Two huge U-Haul trailers full of this stuff. They carefully inventoried it, and they supplied books to research organizations throughout the nation, particularly libraries and other organizations similar to the Human Rights Network that monitor these groups. After dispersing them to the researchers, they still had 3,500 books clogging their office, and they wanted to do something with them, and they really cast about for a time to try to figure out how to get rid of them. And finally, the son of one of the staff people at the network suggested that perhaps they could be used for artwork. One of the Human Rights Network members, Tim Holmes, is an artist, and he is the very first to start exploring transforming them into sculptural forms. And Tim did some very early pieces in 2004 that really seemed to have a great deal of potential. When they realized that the books could be used for art, the Human Rights Network contacted the Holter Museum of Art, and I participated in a meeting representing the museum in which we really brainstormed how an excellent exhibition could be developed. Well, I went back to my colleagues at the museum and just was so excited about the potential of this show to provoke dialogue, to really stimulate deeper exploration of not just the white supremacists, but much deeper, less visible, less dramatic evidence of structural violence or systemic oppression that exists in our society, where members of many different groups are discriminated against unjustly and in ways that are totally inconsistent with our democratic ideals. So it seemed to me to be a great opportunity to get artists involved in addressing some very critical issues of our time. And in fact, as artists began hearing about this, they responded enthusiastically. So the way we organized at the Holter was to invite members of many different organizations in our community to participate in shaping this project, which has from the very beginning been conceived as an integrated educational exhibition program. I am an educator. I'm also an artist dealing with human rights and social justice content in my own work. And I have always felt that our exhibition programs have rich, rich educational potential. But in this case, even more so, the possibility of really engaging in some much deeper dialogue and getting in touch with feelings about how we live together and what kind of society we want to become. So with this very potent work and idea, and in collaboration with the Montana Human Rights Network, members of the Helena Public Schools, and the Lewis and Clark Library, we conceived of a show. And so some artists responded by not actually handling the books, the physical books themselves. Some artists found them very repulsive or scary, or thought that their best way of transformation was to create something else. However, many of the artists sent us proposals for what they would do with these books in order to recontextualize them, put them into a new format, or just entirely reshape them. Or, in the case of several of the artists, take the words and re-edit them to change the message. So we were really excited when we sat down and juried the proposals. We selected 60 artists and artist teams. And from them, we have 99 works of art on exhibition right now. I don't think any of us conceived of the kind of beauty that would develop from the books. For example, Sarah Steele worked with elementary children in Philadelphia at the C.W. Henry School, where every child and teacher and the principal created a peace crane from pages of the book. They also studied the story of Sadako and the Thousand Cranes, a little girl dying of leukemia because of her exposure during the bombing, World War II bombing in Japan. But they took the pages of the books and made them very colorful. And then this painter, Sarah Steele, created a huge watercolor painting with gold leaf of cranes rising up out of the ashes to become these brilliant, bright, colorful, flowery forms. The painting by itself, even without the backstory, would be very beautiful. But again, that wasn't really what we expected at all.
So the whole exhibit is really a testament to diversity.
It is
in and of itself, with all these broad variety of artists and their radically different interpretations of this project is sort of a testament to the power of diversity, which I think is just a beautiful thing. And that is the kind of work that prompts the kind of dialogue and the kind of conversation that the Holter Museum has really worked to make sure surrounds this exhibit. One of the things that you guys have done is several different events that allow people to talk about with each other and sometimes with the artists or with another person who would facilitate the conversation, talk about the ideas and the responses and the emotions that come up when you see an exhibit like this. And I think that you have probably attended some of those conversations. I'm wondering,
oh yeah,
how has that gone? How has that been?
Well, we're right in the midst of it as we sit here and speak, Lenny. There are third graders in the museum. They've just finished looking at selected works. You know, we're not looking at everything with the third graders. They don't really have the background knowledge to understand some of the imagery, but they can totally relate to many of the pieces there, like the one by Sarah Steele and the children, for example. The third graders are responding by sharing their ideas about fairness and bullying and how to change behaviors like rumors. And so the kids are making their own photographic triptychs in which a small group of actors goes through three different steps. First, dramatizing the problem. Second, acting out a solution. And third, portraying the resolution. So some of the learning that's happening is by children as young as 8 and 9 years old who are engaged not just in conversations but also in creativity. And that's really the message or part of the learning process, is that we can create different kinds of relationships through how we interact. The dialogues that have been occurring, I have to emphasize, while they're very lively right now, they've been going on for a couple of years with the members of the steering committee, really reflecting on what's important here, how can we create an environment for learning, how can we prepare, for example, all of the sophomores in the county, in Lewis and Clark County, who read To Kill a Mockingbird and discussed that. Also, the conversations with artists. Artists, I have been in communication with all of these artists over the last about 20 months, and they've been so enthusiastic and really had to seek deep within their own experience and background and kind of lay out a lot of emotions. And I've heard a great deal of communication from them about this process. Many of them actually chose to work with their students. There's actually a mother-daughter team, Dana Bussard and Ariana Bussard-Rifle from Montana, a mother-son team, Jean Quick to See Smith working with her son, Neil Ambrose Smith. So they've been engaged in conversations. There's a group of teachers and students in Helena that did a collaborative book under the guidance of Tim Spire, who have been in conversation, you know, long before the creation of the piece, really identifying what their experience and perspectives were. Just last night, I did a very small tour with some librarians and one of the artists, Clarissa Sly, who's here in Montana doing a residency with us. And wow, the kind of sharing that came out is pretty profound. For example, one of the librarians shared the story of a person in her family who had been gifted a slave for her wedding. And the artist shared the story, a little bit of the story of how her uncle was hung. And that made it very difficult for her to actually even open the books when they arrived. She waited a month and finally got a friend to help her. Several of the artists had this experience of, you know, really having to steel themselves before they handled the material. But Clarissa explained how, as she folded 700 piece cranes for the crown and the mobile she made, each fold seemed like a step toward transformation and inner peace, as well as creating a more peaceful world.
If you're just joining us, my guest this week is Katie Knight, who is the co-curator of education at the Holter Museum of Art in Helena. But the reason I'm talking with her today is because she is curating, she's the main curator, for an exhibit currently on display at the Holter in Helena called Speaking Volumes, Transforming Hate. And it is an exhibit of works of art created to transform books of hate literature.
You know, the whole situation calls for a great deal of compassion. And that's a challenging thing for people like me. As a human rights activist, I have to say that it's very easy to vilify or judge or stereotype someone who might join this kind of movement. And so I have to look at my own prejudices and try to understand what might make someone vulnerable to that sort of organizing. And so one of the really great workshops that I'm looking forward to is called Compassionate Communication. It's using the techniques of nonviolent communication in which you really try to understand the needs and the feelings of other people rather than just, you know, use labels to slap on them and, you know, push them away from your consciousness.
That's a real challenge to try and think that way. Think compassionately about these people mm-hmm. who espouse beliefs that you find so repulsive.
Right, especially at a time when we're actually seeing a rise in hate crimes, 8% increase last year.
When nationwide?
And we know there's an ongoing wave of hate crimes here in Montana. Many times recently, these are directed at individuals who are either gay or lesbian or perceived to be. And, you know, even in Missoula, there have been recent attacks. And so it's really vital that we engage in these conversations and develop more appreciation for each other as human beings, but in addition, ask ourselves, you know, what kind of society do we want to be? How can we create policies? But more importantly, how can we educate our children to values that really do respect diversity?
I'm curious if at any point during the creation process, any of the artists either emailed you or called you and said, I can't do this, or I'm really struggling with this, or, mm-hmm. or this is mm-hmm. so much harder than I thought it was going to be. And, mm-hmm. and you know, and what did you,
oh, yeah.
what did you tell them to make them continue to keep working on it?
Well, you know, there were many artists, many, many more artists ordered the books than actually created pieces. And there were artists who struggled and decided that, you know, they could not bring themselves to make something beautiful from something so ugly. So not all the artists did persevere. However, I'd say the response of the artists who were engaged was just so enthusiastic. Charles Goot in New York is a conceptual artist, and he's an editor by day. And so he actually took words from one of the book pages and did this beautiful editing job in which you can read the original, but then on top of that, he's crossed out in red, made comments, and substituted other words so that by the time you finish the edited version, it's an inspiring statement about respect and urban upliftment and how we can just totally transform our inner cities into places that are very humane and healthy for families. Well, Charles Goot, when he was invited, said, oh, yeah, I would love to do this. I did some jail time with some white supremacists, and I would love to get a hold of this material and really dig in. Similarly, Faith Ringgold, who is an African-American artist, does incredible story quilts that I've loved for decades. She called me up and said, thank you. Thank you for sending me the White Man's Bible. This was a great opportunity. And then Faith goes on to write two different stories and create screen prints from the stories. One is the first time that she was called Nigger on the Street in New York as she was protesting at the Whitney. She was passing out leaflets demanding inclusion of African-American artists in the exhibitions. And this father pulled his little girl away and said, "Don't go near that," so forth. But she also wrote a really poignant story about a father who was struggling with his son's identity. And so I would have to say that I didn't hear from a lot of artists who were reluctant, but amazingly, they were enthused. In fact, every time the project began to seem just too huge and too complicated, I'd end up talking to an artist and they would just say, "Oh, this is great. This is a really good opportunity. And I love addressing these kind of important concerns and getting this stuff out."
So you got encouragement from the artists.
Oh, totally.
To keep going.
That's how it went. Yeah, exactly. And I did have one artist who really struggled about putting her name on the work, who felt fearful. And in fact, there are many, many Jewish artists in this show. And I have to say, I think it's a real act of courage and clear thinking for a Jewish artist to even read these books and deal with this material, because it is so horrific. Mm-hmm. And because, you know, of our really very recent history of the Holocaust. But these artists persevered, and the artist who was afraid to put her name on her work did go ahead and do that. She decided in the end that, yeah, she wanted to stand up and take credit for a creative response to this ugliness.
Have you had any negative responses or any threats? Have you had any contact from the creativity movement or the World Church of the Creator? Have you had anything
no,
like that?
No, we haven't. You know, we have a very broad coalition, and part of our thinking is that, you know, if we do encounter some negativity, we are many and they are few. But I think, you know, people, I see a lot of people going through with very serious expressions, and they don't all come up and speak with me, but very often they do. And even those who seem rather disturbed as they're looking at the show will often come over and just take my hand and say, thank you for doing this.
That's interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Even if it's difficult. Or maybe especially because it's difficult to look at.
Yeah, there are definitely some pieces that are difficult that make me want to just recoil.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I think it all works as a whole. I don't think an entire show of, like, the portrait of Timothy McVeigh and his quote justifying the Oklahoma City bombing, mm-hmm. or the actually beautiful beaded figure of a woman, Laura Nelson, but she's hanging.
Mm, that one
very,
was hard to look at.
It is really excruciating. When I first saw it, I just started crying. But yeah, since I started working on this show, I've done a lot more research into hanging and really, seen a lot of images and discovered much, much more about our own not very distant past and the practice of hanging people, because this artist actually creates a beautiful, what's called a mourning sampler. It's a sewn piece with weeping willows and, you know, commemorating someone's life. But he lifted the figure from a postcard. And the lynching of Laura Nelson in Okemah, Nebraska in 1911 was documented by a photographer, and the whole, you know, all these townspeople posed with the body. Well, actually, I've learned this was very common, that people were very proud to stand by the dead body of the person that they had lynched.
And yet, in the midst of having to deal with this kind of material, just having to think so much about the horrible things that people do to each other, there is this creativity and this transformation. In the catalog for this exhibit, there are several essays, all of which are very well written, and I would definitely recommend to anybody who's interested in this, who cannot actually go and see the exhibit, get in touch with the Holter Museum and purchase a catalog from them. Mm-hmm. In your essay, you say that human creativity is an abundant source of hope. Mm-hmm. And there is inherent in this kind of creativity the concept of hope. People actually think that you can change a society through art.
Well, we are changing. Culture is an ever-changing phenomenon, and we can engage in it really consciously. Art is one way, education another, dialogue, who we love, how we love. It's a very evolving thing, and actually, you don't have to cast your eyes back very far to see that we are progressing. I truly do believe this, even though, you know, we still have ongoing issues. Now, the power of art is that it is so holistic, that it reaches us on a deep, visceral, you know, physical level, an emotional level. It opens our hearts. And at the same time, there's very complex concepts that can be shared and exchanged. So I love that intellectual, spiritual, emotional, kinetic involvement of art. And when we experience an art exhibition, we have a shared experience that then becomes a source for dialogue. Dialogue and awareness of our social issues is absolutely critical to redirecting our energies. And you know, whether the transformation happens on a really personal level and we come to realize, for example, that it's the way we see people that makes them our enemy, not because they were born our enemy, but whether it's that kind of personal transformation that comes through consciousness and examining our own language and labeling and frames that we see the world with.
Katie, I just want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
My pleasure.
And good luck with the rest of the events that you have scheduled.
And if anybody wants to find out about those events, they are listed on the Holter Museum's website, which is www.holtermuseum.org.
Or they can call in Helena 442-6400. You've been listening to a conversation with Katie Knight of the Holter Museum in Helena. We've been talking about the exhibit currently on display titled Speaking Volumes, Transforming Hate, in which artists turned books of hate literature into works of art. This exhibit will be on display at the Holter Museum through April 13th, and it will then travel around the state of Montana over the next 3 years, appearing at the following venues: Copper Village Museum and Art Center in Anaconda, University of Montana Western in Dillon, Carbon County Arts Guild and Depot Gallery in Red Lodge, Custer County Art and Heritage Center in Miles City, Paris Gibson Square Art Museum in Great Falls, Mondack Heritage Center in Sydney, the Emerson Center for Arts and Culture, along with the Helen E. Copeland Gallery at MSU, both of those in Bozeman, the Montana Museum of Arts and Culture in Missoula, and the Yellowstone Art Museum in Billings. As part of this exhibit, the Holter has scheduled several events that give patrons a chance to discuss and explore the topics of hate, bigotry, and prejudice. These include a workshop to use writing as a way to respond to the works in the exhibit, a panel discussion of ways to transform hate in our own communities, and a talk by one of the exhibiting artists. You can find more information about these events and this exhibit at our website, ypradio.org. There you will also find some web-only audio with additional comments about works in this exhibit. Just click on At Large with Lenny Holloman. You've been listening to At Large. I am Lenny Holloman. Thank you for joining me.